Hello, America. This is the place for uncensored talk on everything that divides us as a nation. I'm Alan Jacoby, and welcome to The Great Divide. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Great Divide. I have again with me Roger Stone, the infamous political strategist. Roger, how are you today?
It's great to be with you, and I remind you of Stone's rules. It is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
I love that rule. I think it's great. So today we're going to dive into the truth about Watergate that I know you have a lot of knowledge on. You wrote a book about it, Nixon's Secrets. And first, I just wanted to, we spoke about Nixon last time and a lot of your experiences. You were the youngest staff member of the Nixon campaign. And I was just, I wanted to know how that was and what your duties were.
Sure. I had worked in Nixon's 1968 campaign as the state chairman of Youth for Nixon, and then ultimately Youth for Nixon Agnew in my home state of Connecticut. I was appointed by my political mentor, Connecticut Governor John Davis Lodge, a great man, a very good friend of Reagan's from their Hollywood days, because Lodge had a fairly successful B-movie career, which his family, of course, Brahmins from Massachusetts, frowned upon, but he was a fairly big movie star in Europe, and he was in The Scarlet Empress with Marlene Dietrich. He was in The Little Colonel with Shirley Temple in the United States. In any event, he was a very close friend of Nixon's because they had gone to the House together in 1947, elected the first year. So Lodge was my patron, as it were, and got me appointed to the 68 campaign, and then assisted me in getting hired to work for the committee to reelect the president. At 19 years old, I was the youngest member of the staff. My boss was ecstatic because at 19, he didn't have to pay me what he would pay a 25-year-old. So he had a net budget savings for his department. And quite obviously, I could do the job. Specifically, I was in charge of scheduling the campaign schedules of various pro-Nixon surrogates. Congressman Jack Kemp was one, for example. The treasurer of the United States, Romana Buella, who was one of the early Hispanic appointees. People don't realize this, of course, but Richard Nixon appointed more African Americans to federal positions than Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy combined. So I did get kind of a first row seat for Watergate. At the time, of course, I didn't understand it. I really thought it was just a one-time vendetta and an attempt to remove Nixon from office, largely because the military-industrial complex, today we'd call them the deep state, they were very disappointed in Nixon. You see, Nixon was for peace. That wasn't part of the plan. They didn't want to withdraw from Vietnam at the Pentagon. In fact, they were looking to expand the war. They did not want to reach out to the Chinese and bring them into the family of nations. When Nixon recognized China, there were more ox carts in the country than cars. This is a very backwards nation. Yes. In 1971. There is no way for Nixon to foresee that the Bushes would give the Chinese most favored nation status, nor that the Bushes and the Clintons and the Obamas would allow the Chinese to rob us blind in terms of technology, steal our ideas on the internet, and while they're at it, monkey with our currency, manipulate our currency. So I still count the opening to China as one of Nixon's greatest accomplishments, in that the whole idea was to balance the Russians and the Chinese off right. against each other. They have a common border. And Nixon and Dr. Kissinger figured out that the Chinese feared the Russians more than they feared us, and the Russians feared the Chinese more than they feared us. And if you couldn't make a deal with Brezhnev, okay, Brezhnev, I'll go over and see Mao. Maybe I can make a deal with him. It saved us hundreds of billions of dollars in defense spending. And we had unprecedented peace once the war wound down. And again, Nixon ended the war on a much faster timetable than the Pentagon wanted. But as soon as he became president, he began withdrawing troops from Vietnam. So in retrospect, I now realize that the situation between President Richard Nixon and the situation between President Donald Trump are extraordinarily analogous, very, very simple. Both men were political outsiders, even though Nixon had come through the House and the Senate, but recognize Nixon went from being a lieutenant in the Navy to being vice president of the United States in 6 years.
Wow.
So 2 terms in the House, 1 term in the Senate, right to the vice presidency. Truly a meteoric rise. And Nixon came from the West, didn't go to an Ivy League college, family had no money, had really worked his way into Congress the old-fashioned way, simply by outworking the opposition. And he was never the toast of the elites. He and Jack Kennedy came to the House in the same year, 1947. They were both the two minority members of the House Labor Committee. They traveled the country together debating the Taft-Hartley labor law. Many people don't know this, but Ambassador Joe Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's father, he was half a gangster. He was in the bootlegging business with Frank Costello, but he was a very major donor to Nixon's U.S. Senate campaign against Helen Douglas, who was far too left for the Kennedys. History gets rewritten here, but I think it's important for people to understand. John Kennedy was an ardent anti-communist. John Kennedy wanted a silver or gold-backed dollar. John Kennedy wanted to cut taxes. John Kennedy wanted a massive defense buildup. He felt that we had fallen behind. By today's standards, Jack Kennedy would have been a Republican. You could have never have nominated John Kennedy in today's Democratic Party.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a lot. I didn't know all that. That's pretty remarkable. So we get to Watergate, the real reason for the Watergate investigation, and who was really the driving force, like behind the scenes for that Watergate investigation.
It's very important to understand when trying to analyze Watergate that there's a number of things going on at the same, and there's a cast of characters involved, not all of whom have the same goals and the same motivations. And therefore, there are several versions of Watergate. Here's the version that's not true. That would be the Washington Post, Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein version. Early in Nixon's term, 1969, quite inadvertently, the White House staff becomes aware of the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff have a spy planted in the White House in the military liaison office, a young ensign named Radford. And at night, Radford's going through the building, taking pictures of every document he can lay his hands on, including going through Henry Kissinger's briefcase, because the Pentagon wants to know in advance, what's Nixon doing with China? What's he saying to the Russians? What are we going to do about Vietnam? Spying on the chief executive is, of course, illegal. When Nixon learned about it, he blew a gasket. This is very well documented. You will read it nowhere in the Washington Post.
That's the way mainstream media is, just like they are today. They have this way of, just distorting, like you say, the historical truth.
Well, and as we now know, which we didn't know then, is that of the 8 Watergate burglars, at least 4 of them are still on the full-time payroll of the CIA. At least 4 of them are reporting everything to their case officer. So I think that the Watergate break-in has many origins. First of all, there is no question that John Dean is the guy who envisions, plans, pushes, and covers up the Watergate break-in.
He was the White House counsel, correct, John Dean?
Right. He's the guy who turned whistleblower. So as soon as it all started to go south, he immediately came clean and blamed everybody else. In truth, he was the guy who planned the Watergate break-in. Now, how do we know that? Well, first of all, Tony Ulasewicz and Jack Caulfield, both former decorated New York City cops working in the White House as investigators for the White House counsel's office, both say in their oral histories and their biographies, their oral histories are at Texas A&M, that John Dean sent them to the Watergate office complex at the DNC to case the place out 6 weeks before the break-in. I confronted Dean with that question at a book festival in Austin, Texas, a couple of years ago, and his response was, "No, Roger, LBJ did not kill JFK." So in other words, he avoided the question. There is a school of thought that the purpose of the Watergate, from Dean's point of view, was that his wife, Maureen Dean, had previously worked as a prostitute, and that inside the DNC there was a book, let's call it the Book of Talent, so that when visiting dignitaries came to town, the DNC would hook them up with some female company. 91-year-old Eugene Martinez lives in Miami. I've interviewed him. When arrested, he swallowed the key to the desk drawer where this book was kept. And he insists to this day that that was his assignment. On the other hand, H.R. Bob Haldeman, the president's chief of staff, seemed to believe that the purpose of the break-in was to go into the files of DNC Chairman Larry O'Brien to try to see if O'Brien had dirt on Nixon pertaining to his relationship with Howard Hughes, the billionaire, the Elon Musk of his day. So there you have two motives. Now you have the CIA's motive. Their motive is to get caught. During the actual 48 hours of the incursion into the Watergate, James McCord, still on the payroll of the CIA, but the security chief for the committee to reelect the president, is missing for large periods of time. That's unexplained. Someone obviously makes a decision to tape one of the security doors this way instead of this way, guaranteeing the burglars get caught. They were arrested by a non-uniform undercover unit of the DC police who just happened to be there at the time of the break-in. No, I think the Watergate break-in is, in essence, an attempt by the Central Intelligence Agency to get control of Nixon. Like John Kennedy, Nixon distrusted the CIA. He had very good reason for this. In the 1960 presidential debate with Kennedy, Nixon was shocked when Kennedy came at him from the right, not the left. Kennedy actually out-communist Richard Nixon, saying, "You guys aren't doing enough about the communist menace 90 miles from our shore." Nixon knew there was a secret Bay of Pigs invasion plan on the boards, but he also knew it was classified and he couldn't speak about it. So he felt Kennedy took inappropriate use of his CIA briefing to taunt Nixon, and Nixon never trusted the CIA from that point onward. Also, it's important to recognize that unlike the FBI at the time, the CIA was mostly peopled by Ivy League left of center elites. all of whom thought Jack Kennedy was so cultured and so wonderful, and that Dick Nixon was a guy who didn't know where to put his hands when he was speaking to you. Nixon was, as you know, an introvert in an extrovert's business. Some people would read that as arrogance. It wasn't arrogance. It was shyness. He was for a public man, incredibly shy.
Yeah, I saw that he didn't even from what I was watching and reading about Nixon, he didn't even like to do business in the Oval Office. They had that area. It was I believe they called it the den, where he liked to do most of his business, and he used the Oval Office for just press.
Well, interestingly enough, neither President Nixon nor President Reagan would ever take their jacket off in the Oval Office. They just thought it was inappropriate because it was, you know, the people's office.
Right.
So there was a respect for the presidency and the institution that you didn't see under Clinton when, you know, most people came to the staff meetings in blue jeans.
Yeah, not to mention other things he did in the Oval Office, Clinton, but that's all right. So obviously they were targeting Nixon for whatever reason. Nixon was doing something as president that they made him a target.
I think it is almost solely his foreign policy. The defense intelligence industry, or the defense intelligence segment of the government, did not want to deal with the Chinese, did not want a strategic arms limitation with the Russians, did not want to withdraw from Vietnam. They were already upset about Nixon's desegregation of the public schools. Nixon ends the 18-year-old draft. He does away with the military draft, gives us the 18-year-old vote, unilaterally saves Israel in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when, incredibly, Israeli intelligence is caught asleep at the wheel. They find themselves under a vicious attack by the Syrians and the Egyptians. Their backs are literally against the sea as they run out of munitions. And Golda Meir calls Richard Nixon with an SOS and says, we need the airdrop of millions of dollars of lethal aid in the next 24 hours or the nation will fall. Kissinger is opposed. No, Mr. President, you cannot get involved. It will only provoke the Russians. The Joint Chiefs are opposed. Admiral Thomas Moorer, a great man, but in this case, opposed. And those who worked for Nixon understood, as I did, that often he would give an order. And if you disagree with that order, sometimes you could sit on it and Nixon would change his mind. So when Nixon gave the order to drop $37 million in lethal aid to Israel, those around him hoped he would change his mind the next day, and nothing happens. There's a great Watergate tape. It's funny how you never hear this one on CNN, where Nixon comes in the next day and he says, I believe, to Alexander Haig, then General Alexander Haig, who was an aide to Secretary of State Kissinger, and he says, did the Israelis get the lethal aid we sent them? And he says, no, sir, actually, it hasn't left yet. And Nixon said, what? He says, no, it hasn't left yet. Nixon picks up the phone and he calls the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. That would be Admiral Moorer. And he says, what's the problem? And he said, well, sir, we can't decide what kind of airplane to send it on. Right. Nixon said, if you don't send the material on any plane you have, I don't care what airplane, I'm coming over to the Pentagon and put my foot up your ass. So Nixon, in the end, saves Israel.
Yes.
And while it is true that the Watergate tapes have a number of ethnic slurs and anti-Semitic comments by Nixon, it's very typical of the age. And as Golda Meir said, what counts? Deeds or words? Saving Israel or saying objectionable things? So I really, every time one of my liberal Jewish friends, and I have many, criticizes Nixon. I remind them, no Nixon, no Israel.
Yeah, it's true. He saved Israel. Even the prime minister at the time of Israel had said that. Nixon saved the country, the Yom Kippur War. Absolutely. That's well documented. But, you know, there are people that will talk against that, obviously, and call Nixon an anti-Semite. But like you said, deeds are more important than words.
Well, look, there's no question. His presidency is very complex. So he gets a strategic arms limitation agreement with the Russians against all odds. Mm-hmm. He brings China in out of the cold so he can start saving defense money and play him off against the Russians.
Right.
He launches the war on cancer. He gives us federal revenue sharing in which your tax dollars go to Washington, but they come back to the locality to be spent better.
Right.
He, as I said, does away with the military draft, gives us the 18-year-old vote, saves Israel in the Yom Kippur War, desegregates the schools. See, most Americans think, oh, that must have been Johnson or Kennedy. No, actually, when Nixon became president, almost 80% of the schools in the United States were segregated. And by the time he left, that number was in the teens. And that's without bloodshed, without violence, without incident. Nixon merely firmly, applied the law. So at the same time, removing us from the gold standard, huge mistake.
Right.
By the way, Governor John Connally, then Treasury of the Secretary John Connally, Secretary of the Treasury John Connally, talked him into that doozy. Wage and price controls, major mistake. Some say the opening to China, but I think in retrospect, China was not the world power that it was today, which of course we helped them become. So I think overall, you know, like any president, it has highs and lows, but his accomplishments are very great. Barack Obama never got us a strategic arms limitation agreement with the Russians.
No. You know, he gave money to Iran and weaponized terrorists and apologized to everybody.
And off the books is the worst part. In other words, pallets of cash being pocketed by the mullahs. That's not in the document anywhere. Those are bribes, I think. The part of New York where I'm from, they call those bribes.
Right. But you know, when we say that, they tell us where we're lying and we're conspiracy theorists we know it's true. So the Watergate tapes, there was that whole big thing. I would think it was like, what was it, an 18 and a half minute gap in the White House tapes. And then talk about that, because I don't think that has too much significance. But what eventually just the downfall of Nixon and why he had to resign and then his ultimate reincarnation, I mean, as a foreign policy advisor that Clinton, you know, relied on. But let's the downfall of Nixon, that 18 and a half minute. I know that wasn't the downfall, but that 18 and a half minute.
Well, that becomes the so-called smoking gun. First of all, recognize that Watergate plays out over 2 years. In other words, Nixon carries 49 states in the most historic sweep in history in the 72 elections. The Watergate break-in is a minor issue in that campaign. Nixon's, I think largely because of his pursuit of Alger Hiss, the Russian spy, the 8 years associated with Eisenhower, who was extraordinarily popular, having brought the country unprecedented peace and prosperity. Nixon is going into 1972 in a very strong position. You would have known that in 1970 when the economy was flat. But the so-called military industrial complex has real problems with Nixon's what they would consider soft on communism foreign policy. And therefore, I believe that Nixon's real sin is that he's a peacemaker. I mean, his reputation was as a hardline anti-communist because of his pursuit of Alger Hiss. So those, when he's elected on the right, particularly in the defense industry and the military, they don't see Richard Nixon the peacemaker. They're expecting Richard Nixon the cold warrior. And Nixon believes in democracy, and he believes that talking moves you towards peace. It's not talking is where you can have an accident. And of course, he uses his 8 years as vice president to know virtually every world leader on a first name basis. He spends almost 4 years traveling to foreign nations to prepare him, in essence, for his own presidency. So, yes, I think the Watergate break-in was probably conceived by John Dean, laid out by Gordon Liddy, rejected multiple times by Attorney General John Mitchell, who thought it was both too expensive and a waste of time. Mitchell went to his grave insisting that he never approved the Watergate break-in. There is no evidence that he did. There are witnesses who were present at the time who back his claim that, no, John was against this when it was presented to him. I think the bottom line is John Dean, who had his own motives. Remember, he wants to get those pictures of his wife. And Jeb Stuart Magruder, the campaign manager under Mitchell, they pushed the Watergate break-in for their own purposes in Magruder's position to aggrandize himself and kind of climb the ladder in Nixon world, and Dean's motives we have already discussed. Dean wrote a book which he claimed was the only existing complete collection of transcripts of all of the Watergate tapes, all of the meetings and phone calls that were recorded. But then I went through it, and incredibly, there's three different days that are missing. I think they're March 14th, 17th, and 18th. Those are the days in which you can hear Dean coaching Nixon on perjury and lying to him about whether anyone in the White House was aware of the break-in prior to it happening.
Wow. So I guess big reason to leave them out of his book. So all in all, the whole Watergate scandal, I mean, it's again, Nixon resigned, he reinvented himself, and he came back. And I know you mentioned it in your book, Nixon Secrets, that you became very friendly with him on a daily basis and did things for him after late after his presidency, and which is amazing. And he became like Bill Clinton. It was Bill Clinton that used him as a foreign policy advisor at times, correct?
Well, I mean, look, Nixon put being American way ahead of being a Republican. He had intimate knowledge of what was going on in Russia as the Iron Curtain was beginning to fall. He had excellent contacts in China. He visited both those countries in his 80s at a time when he had phlebitis, which is, you know, blood clots in your legs.
Yeah.
So some danger in flying in that situation. Interestingly, the Bushes, who owe their entire political rise to Richard Nixon, did not treat Nixon particularly well during the Bush presidency. George H.W. Bush never once invited Richard Nixon back to the White House. Bill Clinton did. When Nixon was president, he invited Jackie Kennedy and the Kennedy children back to the White House to see where they had grown up. It was a very gracious thing. And it is absolutely true that the same corporate media cabal was in bed with the Democrats and some members of the judiciary, because it is absolutely true that the Watergate trial judge, the judge over the trial of the eight burglars, is communicating constantly ex parte with the Watergate prosecutors. If we'd known that at the time, he would have been impeached as a judge. Their appeal is pre-wired by the judge, who talks to the appeals, the circuit court appeals judges. So Sirica becomes a national hero because he's so tough on the Watergate burglars, but he's breaking the law. When I said that on MSNBC, this character, Nick, I'll forget his name in a moment, but worked as a Watergate prosecutor, went out of his mind. But it is absolutely documented in my later book, Tricky Dick, The Rise, Fall, and Rise of Richard Nixon, where I got additional information which proves that Sirica acted illegally in the Watergate burglars trial in order to put pressure on Nixon. The idea here was between the cabal and the media, which was every bit as vicious to Nixon as today's media is to Donald Trump, to get Nixon out of the way. Nixon made it at the juncture that Nixon figured out that he did not have the votes in the Senate to sustain an impeachment and that he was going to be removed. Concurrently, Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned in a corruption scandal pertaining to his days as governor of Maryland. And Nixon actually believed that by appointing Gerald Ford president, he had bought an insurance policy. Or as he said at the time, are you kidding me? Jerry Ford is so dumb, they'll never make him president. He was wrong about that.
And I'm not going to use the word manipulated. I think you might have even said in your book, blackmailed Ford, Nixon's pardon. Didn't he used
Nixon, Ford Nixon for become, his, Nixon became his pardon? Aware. Nixon became, remember, in the late 60s, Nixon is quoted in his interview as saying that the Warren Commission, studying the murder of John Kennedy, to use his words, is the biggest damn hoax in American history. So Nixon had his own suspicions about what really happened in Dallas, recognized the involvement of organized crime, recognized the involvement of Big Texas Oil, recognizes the involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency, knows that Lyndon Johnson is bloodthirsty and will do anything to become president, but more specifically, will do anything to avoid going to prison because Johnson is under two corruption investigations, the Billy Sol Estes investigation and the Bobby Baker investigation. So Nixon is essentially removed in a bloodless coup. Gerald Ford becomes president. At that point, I believe, based on an interview I had with General Alexander Haig, Nixon was very focused on Gerald Ford's role as a member of the Warren Commission. During that investigation, at the request of J. Edgar Hoover, Gerald Ford, in a pencil, removes on the official diagram from the autopsy the wound from Kennedy's upper back to his lower neck in order right. to accommodate the single bullet theory put together by my friend Arlen Specter, who as a poor investigator is called in by, he's 27 years old, I believe, called in by the CIA, the former CIA director, Alan Dulles, the current FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren. The FBI conducted and completed their entire investigation into the Kennedy assassination in 5 days. And then concluded Lee Harvey Oswald did it. He was a lone nut communist acting alone. All right, get that Specter kid in here. Kid, we've already figured this out. So we've got the conclusions. Now go write the support, report that will reflect our conclusions, which was, pardon me, just make sure it's not the white. It's not Donald Trump, so I won't.
Oh, all right. We can do it.
So it is absolutely clear that this is a bloodless coup, and Nixon, who had never been the favorite of the establishment press, is removed. And Nixon chooses Ford because Ford is a man on whom he has leverage. Nixon is quoted as saying, if I'm going down, I'm taking everybody with me. Yeah. And of course, he knew the secrets, not only of the Kennedy assassination, but many secrets about government. And in the end, I think Ford had no choice but to pardon him. In retrospect, historically, that turned out to be the right thing to do for the country. It's very important to recognize that throughout his entire ordeal, through both good times and bad, Nixon still retained a hardcore support from about a third of the American people who know him and admired him all the way back to Alger Hiss and his famous trip to Caracas, where he stood up to a vicious communist mob, which has tried to turn his car over through throwing rocks. He was covered in spit, but he never flinched. He showed great bravery in Caracas, where he had been sent by President Eisenhower on a peace mission. So he was far better prepared going into the 1960 election with the largely unknown but incredibly handsome Jack Kennedy. He makes a giant mistake and agrees to four televised debates. Now, the historians will tell you they only focus on the first debate. The first debate, Nixon had bumped his knee on a car door, had developed a staph infection, was actually hospitalized for 2 weeks after Labor Day, which had to be very frustrating. Seeing Kennedy crisscross the country running up a lead, Nixon is bedridden. He has a fever. He's on antibiotics. He comes roaring out of the hospital, does five campaign stops on his way to Chicago, shows up at Chicago for the debate, the first debate, completely exhausted, still running a fever. Jack Kennedy shows up a day early. He is sunning himself on the roof with two topless hookers. So they talk about the lighting test, kind of like the weigh-in in a fight.
Right.
Both candidates come in to look at the studio, check the lighting. They're shown how the microphone system works. They say that Jack Kennedy, I think it was Teddy White wrote this, looked like a bronzed god. And Jack, when it came to Dick Nixon, they said his face was almost as gray as his suit.
Yeah, I think I read something like that in your other book, Stone's Rules. You were saying the importance of doing before you do a debate or an event, you could sun yourself for a half hour. You have to be careful. You don't get over. You're burned. And Nixon was notorious for not wearing makeup, apparently.
Television, was the medium, and therefore the way you looked was every bit, if not more, important than what you had to say. Now, two things are true. Those who listened to the debate on the radio overwhelmingly believed Nixon had won. Those who watched it on television, far more, obviously believed that Kennedy had won. Henry Cabot Lodge, Nixon's running mate for vice president, a man who took a nap every afternoon at 3 in his pajamas, not exactly the hardest campaigner you've ever met, watched it on TV, called Nixon and said, "You blew it. You blew it for us." Lyndon Johnson, who listens to the debate on a radio in Texas, in a car radio, calls JFK and said, "I hate to tell you this, Jack, but I think Nixon kicked your ass."
Wow.
Just very interesting in the difference between the visual and the audio. But again, from the beginning of the first debate, Nixon's 15 pounds overweight. He has refused makeup. During the weigh-in, the lighting test, Don Hewitt, the producer, says to Senator Kennedy, "Senator Kennedy, will you be requiring makeup?" "No makeup for me." "Mr. Vice President, will you be requiring makeup?" Nixon doesn't want to look like a pussy, so he says, "No, no makeup for me." Kennedy then goes back to his dressing room, where his private makeup man, who was flown in from New York, makes him up. And Nixon argues with his aides about whether he needs makeup. They say, "Dick, you're pale. You've got 5 o'clock shadow. You can't go out there like that." So they send out for a product called Lazy Shave, which is a powder which essentially covers your beard and conceals the 5 o'clock shadow. The problem with that is in the debate, when Nixon is shocked that Kennedy's coming at him from the right on the missile gap, Quemoy and Matsu, two islands where fighting with the Chinese over Cuba, Nixon begins to sweat. As he sweats, the makeup begins to run. He literally melts down on national television. Mayor Daley, the mayor of Chicago, speaking to a giant Democratic rally where they watched it on a big screen, says, "Jesus, he's not even dead yet, and they've already embalmed him."
Oh, wow.
Now, yeah, what people don't understand is there's three more debates. And in every debate, first of all, Nixon goes on a regimen of milkshakes, gains 15 pounds quickly. So he fills out his shirts, gets himself a sun lamp. The second debate was considered his best. The third is also scored as a victory for him. And here's the kicker. The left-wing historians will tell you that the audience for the first debate dwarfed the audience for the subsequent debates. Not true. The final debate only got 100,000 households less than the first debate, and it was Nixon's best debate. Also, you had a backstage drama going where Mamie Eisenhower, the first lady, Dwight Eisenhower's wife, went to Pat Nixon, Nixon's wife, and said, you know, Ike's heart condition will really not allow him to campaign for Dick. We just feel it would be too arduous and too much of a strain. So please ask Dick not to ask Ike to campaign for him. Eisenhower knows nothing about this. Every week goes by, he's furious that Nixon won't ask for help. He says, and I quote, "The son of a bitch thinks he can win it on his own." Eisenhower is contemptuous of Jack Kennedy, doesn't believe he has the qualifications or the experience to be president. Finally, Eisenhower says, "The hell with it, I'm not being asked anymore." In the last week, he does giant rallies in New York, Philadelphia, and LA. I make the case in the book, both books really, that the 1960 election, despite Nixon's many mistakes, and he made many, I still believe he won. I believe that election was stolen from him in both Illinois and Texas.
Huh. Wow. It's.
And you wonder why he was bitter.
It's pretty remarkable.
Well, they say, you know, Nixon was paranoid. Well, you know, if a bootlegger with a son with an IQ of 79 came along and beat you, you'd be pretty upset too. I mean, everybody who ever met Jack Kennedy liked him. He was gracious, thoughtful, graceful, articulate, cultured guy. But he was far more interested in the ladies than he was in public policy. And of course, Nixon was the exact opposite, uncomfortable in his own skin, middle class in his values, not a glamour boy by any means. So there's no question, if you look at it historically, that Nixon is fueled by his resentment. He is fueled by his rage. He sees things, as Trump does, in terms of them, the elites, the insiders, those for whom the law doesn't apply, and then everybody else, the regular working people. Right. He identified with the latter and not the former. He was truly a man of the people, came from a dirt poor background, no privilege in his case. He was applied to become an agent of the FBI. He was rejected. He applied to the fanciest law schools in the East. He was rejected, although he did end up going to Duke Law School, a very fine school. So there's no question that the results and the cheating in the 1960 election are what lead to the Watergate break-in. Nixon vows never to be outmaneuvered again.
The whole Watergate scandal in itself, how do you think it would play out in today's political climate?
This is really quite extraordinary. So let's think about this. What happened in Watergate was a small group of private citizens paid for by the committee to reelect the president broke into the Watergate Hotel, and retrieve nothing whatsoever of value. No recordings, no documents. The mission was a failure.
Right.
Barack Obama used the full authority of the United States government and the extraordinary capability of our intelligence agencies for the strictly political purposes of spying on Donald Trump and his campaign.
That's right.
That's the greatest abuse of power in American history. That makes Watergate look like small potatoes. Back during Watergate, what did they say? No man is above the law. Okay, what about you, Barack Obama, and you, Joe Biden? Because you approved the spying on the Trump campaign on the basis of no real evidence of Russian collusion. In fact, you approved it based on fabricated material, the so-called Steele dossier.
That's right. So yeah, I could see. Huh? Wow. Okay. We went through a lot, Roger. That was that's a lot of information, I think, on Watergate that a lot of people aren't aware of, and even how it pertains to today, like with Obama spying on Donald Trump's campaign. It's I want everyone out there to get Roger's books, Nixon Secrets. What's the other book?
The other book is Tricky Dick: The Rise, Fall, and Rise of Richard M. Nixon. Look. Nixon is a guy who dominates politics in this country for a 40-year period. He's actually on 6 national tickets, more than any American in history. Right. He is indefatigable. People ask me, you know, why do you have a tattoo of Nixon on your back? Well, first of all, I'm the only guy in the world with a dick on the front and the back. But more importantly, to me, that tattoo, which I see in the mirror every morning, it's not a political statement. It's a reminder that in life, when things don't work out the way you want to, when you strive for something but you don't achieve it, when you fall short, when you're defeated, when you lose, when you're dejected and you're discouraged, well, that's the time you have to get up off the mat, dust yourself off, and get back in the game. Nixon paraphrased Vince Lombardi. It's not how many times you get knocked down that counts. It's how many times you get back up. So Nixon's story is a story of resilience. It's a story of persistence. It's a story of never giving up. And that's what I admire about him. He was not an ideologue. He was not a purist, more of a purist like Reagan. He was a pragmatist. He had some very conservative views. He had some more progressive views, particularly in the civil rights area. But I think the problem here is the great accomplishments of his time in office are essentially buried. Most people don't know he saved Israel.
No.
Most people don't know that he desegregated the public schools.
Right.
Gave us the Office of Minority Business Enterprise, tripled the funding for black colleges, increased by 90% the Justice Department budget for civil rights law enforcement, gave us affirmative action, which many conservatives object to. I support, because I do think people who had disadvantages deserve some small advantages. Overall, I think all this gets lost in the din of history. Nixon, Watergate. Nixon,
that's it.
Watergate. It's kind of like Trump impeachment.
Right.
They don't mention that he gave us the most robust, vibrant economy in our history. They don't mention that he rebuilt our military strength. They don't mention that he put generations of conservatives on the federal courts. No, it's all Nixon, Russian collusion, impeachment. It's nonsensical.
But that's how everything is. You know, Roger, that's why why I wanted to do this 4-part episode series with you, because again, like you said, Trump impeachment. Well, then they look, Roger Stone. Oh, Robert Mueller, convicted felon, got pardoned from the big bad orange man. Oh, Roger Stone, the political operative.
Really, it's funny you mentioned that, because last Friday, in the January 6th defendants case, the prosecutors actually wrote a piece saying Roger Stone's trial is proof that a Trump supporter can get a fair trial in D.C. I almost fell off my chair. My first, fourth, and fifth constitutional amendment rights were violated at his trial. The judge's bias showed at every occasion. There was prosecutorial misconduct in which exculpatory evidence was withheld from me, including the last remaining unredacted sections of Mueller's report, in which he concluded there was no evidence against me whatsoever regarding Russian collusion, WikiLeaks collaboration, or John Podesta's highly embarrassing emails. But they didn't tell you that before the trial because it would have undercut their entire case. You can't lie to Congress about things you don't know about, can you?
Absolutely.
So it is unbelievable that anyone with a straight face would make the case that D.C. is a safe place where these people can get a fair trial. The exact opposite is true. I was gagged for 18 months during my trial, couldn't defend myself while CNN and The Washington Post were pissing all over me. That's unconstitutional. I couldn't raise the issue of the corruption by the special counsel's office, the FBI, the Department of Justice, or any member of Congress, Adam Schiff, in my defense. Unconstitutional under Kyle v. Whitley. The first eight pages, by the way, Kyle v. Whitley says, the integrity of the an indictment is always grounds for defense. But the judge didn't see it that way.
Right.
No. They also, interestingly, even though the first seven pages of my indictment say flatly, the Russians hacked the DNC and gave the information to WikiLeaks. There's no proof of that. My lawyers forced the FBI to admit they never even inspected the DNC computer servers. But the judge refused to let me use forensic evidence and expert testimony to disprove the entire underlying premise of my case. The judge attacked me repeatedly for using social media to publicize my opinion.
Right.
Perhaps she's not familiar with the First Amendment, that I'm entitled to have out-of-the-box political opinions or historical opinions as an American citizen. But she made it sound nefarious. This man uses the internet to push disinformation.
Right.
Well, the Russian collusion hoax was the greatest dirty trick of all time. Talk about disinformation. If I'm a dirty trickster, it takes one to know one. And that's the greatest dirty trick of all time.
Absolutely. Roger Stone. Where StoneColdTruth.com. That's where you can get all your books, right? StoneColdTruth.com.
That is correct. We're still revamping the store. I'm going to jump on a call about that immediately after this. But that is where you should be able to get my signed books. Also, as you know, my wife is actually making real progress in her battle against cancer. She was diagnosed as stage 4 cancer about a month ago. The most recent tests show she's making steady progress in her defeat of the disease. She's not out of the woods by any means, but for those millions of Americans who are praying for her and for us, God bless you. The non-AMA approved alternative holistic and homeopathic treatments for cancer are extraordinarily expensive. I have to go out and raise the money to pay for them, but I do so gladly. And folks who want to help us can go to StoneFamilyFund.com.
Absolutely. StoneFamilyFund.com. I'm going to put everything in the show notes like I did the last time. Everything will be there. And listen, we're going to get together again for episode 3, The Truth About JFK. I'm looking forward to that. And LBJ and all that, the assassination. That's going to be great. Roger, I appreciate it, as always, for you joining me and giving us this unbelievable information, things that most Americans don't know about really important things in American history. So I really appreciate you joining me, Roger.
Well, we're educators here at The Great Divide. Great to be back with you. I got great feedback on our last program, and I look forward to laying out the facts about the Kennedy assassination in our next show.
And that we will. Everybody, thank you for tuning in and joining us, The Great Divide. Go to the website, thegreatdivide1776.com. Don't forget, go over to Roger Stone's website, stonecoldtruth.com, and thestonefamilyfund.com. It'll all be in the show notes. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and most of all, God bless America. You take care. You can reach out to me with opinions and ideas for other episodes at TheGreatDivide1776@gmail.com. You can also find me on social media at The Great Divide Podcast. And please be sure to leave a review for this podcast so the show can be shared to other listeners. Thank you, and God bless America.